Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Robert Fripp, Notorious Markets, and Tegan and Sarah. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Christopher Cook. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Andrew.
We've had a few weeks off, so this week, I'm just informing listeners, basically, I've changed the script slightly. Don't be upset. This week, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last few weeks.
Yeah, the script template says the last 7 days. That's your point.
Yeah.
And there might be some which are 9 days, and we didn't want to be sued. So,
yeah.
So we're going for the last few weeks. Actually, let's cover ourselves. The last few months.
Just all of time.
Maybe at some point in the past. Everything we're going to talk about today happened at some point in the past.
I can tell you something that did happen in the last week.
What did happen in the last week?
A judge found a novel way not to give in to Jay-Z's unreasonable demands.
This is relating to a perfume case.
Yes.
A perfume
legal case,
yes.
Not a case of perfume.
Not a case of perfume.
There was a case of perfume involved.
There was.
I mean, lots of cases.
But not many being sold, which is
yes.
Part of the problem. So a few years ago, Jay-Z did a deal with a perfume company,
yep.
Presumably because he had a look at Beyoncé's accounts and saw how much money she was making by flogging perfume with her name on the side of the bottle.
Yeah.
So he thought, I'll have a bit of that. So he did a deal with this perfume company. His name went on the bottle. But then subsequently, after sales were a bit disappointing, they said that he hadn't lived up to his promotional commitments.
Yes.
I think he didn't tweet about it enough or something.
Something like that. They said that he'd agreed to do certain promotional things during the promotional campaign for this perfume. Gold Jay-Z, I think it was called. It's not a very good name.
Maybe that's why nobody bought it. That's why he was embarrassed to promote it.
And maybe. Maybe it doesn't smell very nice. Who knows? Because I haven't bought any. No one did.
No one did. He didn't promote it.
Well, the company said they lost $18 million. So that's, no one bought it.
Nobody bought it.
Anyway, they said that was because Jay-Z didn't promote it and sued him.
And this case has been rumbling through the courts for a while now. And
mainly because he keeps making demands.
Well, they want to do what is known in legal circles, particularly in America, a deposition. So that's where you get people involved in a case in a room and lawyers ask them questions, but crucially under oath. So it's like being in the courtroom without being in the courtroom. And then you record that and then both sides can then have that to help them prepare their cases. Sometimes clips of that will then be shown in court. The Blurred Lines case. We have the hilarious depositions that Robin Thicke and Pharrell did and that the bits of those got showed in public. So they've been desperately trying to get a deposition with Jay-Z. And then for ages, he kept saying he was too busy. Far too busy.
Yeah.
So much going on. But then it turned out that his real concern was that the whole thing was going to be filmed. Part of this is they want him to basically go through his entire schedule, his diary from the period when this promo was meant to be happening.
Not even just a small amount, like several years worth of his personal and business diary so they can see his whereabouts.
And because all of that would be on camera, it turned out his fear, or at least his latest excuse, was he was frightened that that video might leak and then there might be personal information in that video and that would be embarrassing, it would damage his brand.
Yeah, I mean, where was Jay-Z and that was so embarrassing? That's what I want to know.
That he wasn't able to promote his perfume and he doesn't want anyone to know about it. So having put off this deposition, eventually he said, okay, it's the video bit I don't want. If we could not video it, I'll do it. But then the judge was saying, well, we always video depositions. Even, was it Mariah Carey? He said, even Mariah Carey had her depositions filmed.
Twice. Yes.
So you, Jay-Z, you can have your deposition filmed. But you mentioned this fudge he came up with so that Jay-Z didn't get exactly what he wanted, but it was acknowledging Jay-Z's concerns.
Yes. So the issue was everyone in the case, each party gets a watermarked copy of the video so that they can watch it back and enjoy it.
The watermarking meaning if they were to upload it to YouTube or some file sharing network, you would know which of the legal teams had done that and then you could beat them on the head.
Yes. But the problem is the person who makes the video keeps an unwatermarked copy and a version of it will be uploaded to some kind of online storage.
They were worried
that left open to the potential of a leak. So the judge came up with this fudge, which was, we won't upload it to the internet. There you go. No one's going to hack it and steal it that way. And if you're worried about this other unwatermarked copy, well, why don't you, all of the legal teams involved in this, get together and destroy it.
And smash it up.
Yeah, but we don't know what they're going to do. I think they'll probably burn it in a bin.
Don't know. Is that a tape or is it a CD, DVD?
I do not know. I imagine tape, but that's because that's just more fun burning in a bin.
It would be, or stamping on it. The point is, more traction from stamping on tape.
Everyone would see it burning in a bin and know that it had been destroyed and it wasn't going to get leaked.
So that was a development this week. So on the back of that, Jay-Z is now meant to be doing this video deposition, safe in the knowledge that there's absolutely no way that anything that is said in that room can leak until it does, probably.
I mean, it'll be transcribed as well, won't it? So, and the court case will be public. So
we'll probably find out some of it. We'll look forward to all of that. So that was one development this week, but not a development that we're here to talk about.
No, this week we're actually going to be talking about the US record industry's latest piracy gripe list and Tegan and Sarah's new way to fight back against ticket touts. But first, musician Robert Fripp, who is best known as founder and the longest serving member of King Crimson, has publicly discussed an ongoing dispute he's had with the David Bowie Estate and collecting society PPL about his contributions to Bowie's Heroes and Scary Monsters albums and the way that they have been classified.
And particularly the way his role on those tracks have been classified in the system.
Mm. Yes, because on the face of it, it might seem like semantics, but the way a role is classified by PPL has a bearing on how royalties are paid out.
Yes, there was a financial implications to how Robert Fripp's performance on these Bowie tracks. No one's denying that he performed on them.
No.
Nobody's denying that his performance was a crucial part of those tracks. But crucially, as you say, how he is classified in the database has an impact on how he shares in some of the money that is generated around these tracks. So this all relates to the money collected on behalf of the record industry by PPL, PPL being the UK Record Industry's collecting society.
Yeah, so it's the society that collects money on behalf of the record industry when music is played on the radio or in pubs, clubs, bars, cafes, gyms,
hairdressers,
corner shops,
train stations. Does music get played in train stations? Recorded music?
I used to live near a tube station that played classical music.
Did they?
Mm.
Oh, interesting. Because obviously some have the pianos, don't they? But that wouldn't involve a recording.
No.
That would only involve a composition, and that PPL's not involved when someone's playing the piano.
Right, yes.
But they are if it's recorded music being played through a sound system in a public space. And from a copyright perspective, all of these uses of recorded music, whether it's going out on the radio or it's being played through a sound system in a public space, that is exploiting what I would refer to as the performing rights of the copyright. So the performance and communication controls of the copyright, to use CMU terminology, which is what everybody should use when they're talking about copyright. But what some people might call the performing rights, although what the record industry insists on calling the neighbouring rights.
Yes.
I wish they'd stop doing that.
Well, then, because then there would be one less thing that was referred to as neighbouring rights.
Neighbouring rights is such a confusing term with multiple definitions. But in the UK, generally, when the record industry talks about neighbouring rights, they're talking about the performance and communication controls of the copyright, the elements of the copyright that are exploited when radio broadcasts music and when recorded music gets played in a public space. The reason why this is important, and particularly important to Robert Fripp, is that in copyright law, there's a little section in the Copyright Act called performer rights, not to be confused with performing rights.
Oh, this is confusing as well.
And what the performer rights say is that when the performing rights of the copyright are exploited, is any money generated is shared between the copyright owner and any of the performers who appear on the sound recording. And that's quite an important point, because when recorded music is exploited in other ways, such as when CDs are sold or vinyl is sold, so that the reproduction and distribution elements of the copyright are being exploited, but not the so-called performing rights or neighbouring rights, in that scenario, all the money would go to the copyright owner, which traditionally would be a record company, and then that record company would share that money with some of the artists who appear on the record, but subject to contract. So quite what the copyright owner does with that money and how much they hand over to the artist will depend on the contract that label has with the artist. So they might be sharing most of the money with the artist. They might be sharing half of the money with the artist. If it's a major label deal, they're probably sharing no more than 20% of the money with the artist. If it's a 1960s deal, like the deal, I don't know what Bowie's deal was back in the day, but older record deals, it could be like 5% of the money going to the artist. And crucially, only going to the artist with which the label has an ongoing relationship, which is what traditionally the record industry refers to as the featured artist. This story is full of confusing terminology.
Mm.
So in the old school record industry, when you talked about the featured artist, David Bowie had a deal with his record company.
Yeah.
And therefore is the featured artist. And the records are released under his name. But obviously, because he's a solo artist, a very talented solo artist, but he usually has other musicians on his records.
Yes.
Which we might traditionally refer to as the session musicians, who will have a one-off agreement with the label just for that recording session, where they're usually paid a fee. But those session musicians certainly won't be cut into any copyright created in those recording sessions, and actually wouldn't usually have a royalty. They wouldn't be paid any money by the label once that recording starts making money. They get their fee, and they bugger off, and that's it. And that's how the money would usually be shared, except money generated by the exploitation of the performing rights, which in the UK is the money that PPL collects. Because of this performer right, known as performer equitable remuneration, or what I like to call performer ER.
Because it's just easier for you to say.
Because it's quite hard to say. And actually, in the original edit of this, it took me about 7 goes to get it right. So
just 7.
From this point onwards, let's call it performer ER.
Mm.
And what the performer ER rule says is that whenever money is generated by exploiting the performing rights or the neighbouring rights or the sound recording, this money gets split 50-50 between the copyright owner and the performers who appear on the track. And the contracts that the copyright owner, as I say, traditionally that would be a label, the contract that label has with either the featured artist or the session musician is irrelevant. Don't care what the contract says. The contract cannot interfere with this. Half of that money will go directly to all the performers who appear on the track. The money never even goes through the record company's bank account because PPL collects this money. It has both labels and performers as members. So the money comes in, it splits it 50-50. Half goes to the copyright owner, which would usually be a label. I mean, obviously, these days, more and more artists keep control of their sound recording copyrights, although often they have a label or a distributor who would actually collect that 50% that's going to the copyright owner. Crucially, very crucially for this particular story, that money is then shared out between what I've referred to as the featured artists and the session musicians. But it's not equally shared out.
No.
Between those different performers. So copyright law has no opinion on this. Copyright law doesn't even say the 50-50 split. It just says the performers should get their ER. It doesn't define what that means. So PPL has set this up. The industry has agreed on this. The labels, the copyright owners over here, the performers over here. But the way PPL usually do it is that of the 50% that's allocated to performers, about 2/3 of it will go to the featured artists. The other third is shared out with the session musicians. There are some other complications there in terms of there being different kinds of featured artists, and also on the session musician side, there is a cap as to how much any one session musician will receive. So if there's a single session musician on the track, they're not going to get a third.
Mm.
So there are some extra complications, but the basic rule is of the half that's going to the performers, 2/3 will go to the featured artist, 1/3 to the session musicians, which brings us to Robert Fripp's classification on these Bowie tracks, because he is listed as a session musician and he thinks that because of the contribution he's made, he should be listed as a featured player.
Yes, I mean, it's generally agreed that he was a collaborator with Bowie on these records rather than just some guy who came in and played a bit of guitar. It would never have occurred to me that there was any dispute over this because there's so much classified as David Bowie and Robert Fripp working together. So that he's come out and said that he's got this ongoing issue with the estate and with PPL to get his status reclassified as a featured artist was quite surprising when he posted about it on Facebook.
But the issue is how PPL's distribution rules, as they call them, which I had to download and read when I was reporting on this story, how those PPL rules define a featured artist. And it's not just based on what Andy Malt thinks about somebody's contribution. I mean, that would
should
be a,
be. Would
that
be would a make system, it easier.
Although you'd have to have a lot of opinions on a lot of records.
Don't worry about that.
But basically, the PPL rules, in essence, have two criteria for a featured artist. And if you tick either of them, then you're likely to be classified as a featured player by PPL. So the first is, what is your contractual relationship with the copyright owner? So if you are the artist that has a full record deal with the copyright owner rather than a one-off session deal, then you will be classified as a featured artist. Or if you are credited in the official release of the record. So for example, had they been released as David Bowie and Robert Fripp, or even David Bowie featuring Robert Fripp, actually, when you talk to younger artists about featured artists, they assume that's what that term means.
Yeah.
Because guest artists have become very common over the last 10 years, really. I mean, obviously, there's always been X featuring Y, but it has become a lot more common in more recent years. And if that release back in the day had been David Bowie and Robert Fripp, or David Bowie featuring Robert Fripp, then under PPR rules, he would be classified as a featured player, but he wasn't. But what he is saying is, Bowie often informally, in essence, referred to it in that way. And it's just that these records were released in an era where you didn't tend to put featuring in the title.
Yeah.
So in essence, he's being disadvantaged by the fact that PPL rules are kind of written for a modern way in which records are released. And therefore, because this is a record from back in the day, he's missing out on his listing as a featured artist and therefore the royalty boost that would come with it.
Yes. So both Fripp and his business partner, David Singleton, have written about this online. Fripp on this Facebook post that we'll come on to, and David Singleton in a blog post on Robert Fripp's company's website, in which he says, there is a huge injustice in the way that current rules are applied to historic recordings, in particular to those who would now be called other featured artists, outside artists who made defining contributions to recordings. This would include Robert Fripp's performances on David Bowie's albums, but could also extend, for example, to Eric Clapton on While My Guitar Gently Weeps or Duane Allman on Layla. He goes on, we argue that such historic, iconic performances should rightly be categorised as other featured artists, as they almost certainly would be if they were recorded today. That category, however, had not been invented at the time, so PPL insists on downgrading them to non-featured artist, an honourable but very large category where they also place all session musicians and backing singers.
So this dispute between Fripp and the Bowie estate and PPL has clearly been ongoing for a while, so it's interesting that Robert Fripp decided now was the time to take to Facebook to basically air his frustrations to his fan base. And then, as you say, his business partner followed up with a slightly more detailed explanation on the company website. But I suppose it was interesting in the Facebook post, what Fripp in essence was saying was, this is an ongoing frustration of mine, talking to all the parties, but almost...
He's getting passed between the two.
Well, exactly. So the Bowie estate are saying, oh, well, this is a PPL issue, there's nothing we can do about it. And then PPL are saying, oh, this is a Bowie estate issue, there's nothing we can do about it. And he just feels that there is no progress because they keep going backwards and forwards between the two parties.
Yeah, so he said, essentially, the David Bowie estate argues that my featured performer status is not acknowledged by PPL rules. And PPL argues that as the David Bowie estate does not accept me as a featured performer, I am therefore not a featured player. And their rules confirm this. Anyone read Catch 22?
Yeah, so he's in
and
a bit
I
of...
haven't. I've had it on my shelf for years. This really made me think I should read that.
Get reading Catch 22. But even though you've not read it...
I mean, I understand the concept.
You understand the concept.
He basically just described it, didn't he?
Of being stuck in a vicious circle, in essence.
Yeah.
In that going backwards and forwards, saying, we can't do anything, it's PPL rules. And then PPL saying, we can't do anything, this is how Bowie has defined you. Etc., etc., etc. PPL has responded to this.
Yes, it said that it distributes royalties to more than 100,000 performers and labels according to a set of distribution rules.
Those were the rules I read.
That have been in place.
There's a lot of them, I can tell you that. Took me quite a while.
Don't interrupt me. That have been in place for some time and were approved by individuals representing a broad cross-section of the recorded music industry and both featured and non-featured performers. Whilst we are unable to comment on individual cases, performers are classified using a performer classification system set out in PPL's published distribution rules, which Chris has read.
I've read them.
All classification is made based on applying the information we receive from the relevant parties to these rules. It is important to point out, they go on, that the classifications within these rules do not seek to make any value judgment on the quality, importance, or extent of a performer's contribution on a recording. PPL is always mindful of the different ways in which all of our members can be affected by our policies, and we remain committed to operating a fair and straightforward system of distributing revenue to all performers.
So, in essence, a slightly non-committal statement from
yes.
the collective side.
Yes, although there is possibly a reason for being a bit non-committal.
But in essence, I suppose what they were trying to stress was that their rules for how people get classified and then what happens to the money. And to be fair, you know, they are all there on the website. You don't have to be a PPL member. Anyone can go on the website, download these PDFs, and it does explain how things work. So in essence,
yeah.
they were sort of saying, there's nothing dodgy going on behind the scenes. This is just an application of the rules that are there.
Yes, and the reason they might be quite firm on that and just say, we're just doing what we do, is that they would probably be quite concerned that if they say to Robert Fripp, well, clearly, you were, you know, a featured collaborator with Bowie on this. It's obvious that your status is higher than you're currently classified as. We'll just change it for you. Then suddenly lots of people are going to come forward and go, well, actually, I worked on this track and I was a bit more than, I didn't just bang a drum, you know. And then that's quite a lot of work for them, isn't it?
Yeah, and don't want to end up having to be involved in debates about, well, what was your contribution? How
I mean,
do we define?
You might also get featured artists, you know, the top level named artists on the track coming forward and going, this person's a featured artist, and they did nothing. They just banged a drum and went home.
Although there is potentially a little bit of flexibility in the system, or there could be a little bit of flexibility in the system, where if the featured artist, the person who is listed as a featured artist, in hindsight, with retrospect, is happy to say, actually, yes, if we were to release this as a new record today, we would be giving that person billing on the record, which would then mean they would get featured artist classification under the PPL rules, then maybe the featured artist could change things in the database. I suppose that then does pose the question of, well, what about all the royalties in the past? Do we have to go and redo all the maths? Probably not.
Well, you'd have to come to an agreement, wouldn't you? Say, we're not going to hand over a load of money to you. We're just going to change your status and things can change from now on.
Yes. Do you draw a line and say, okay, moving forward? So who knows? I mean, these conversations, I'm
because these songs are old.
Yes.
And popular.
The conversations, I am sure, continued behind the scenes. I don't know whether Robert Fripp and his team felt that by going public, that would help their case, or maybe it would make the Bowie estate become a bit more proactive. Because potentially it's easier for them to sort this out than it is for PPL to sort this out.
Yes.
And so there was an element of, you sense, nobody wants to diss Bowie or his legacy, but maybe actually it's on that side that something could be done. But who knows? But I did think he was raising an interesting point. And as his business partner also pointed out, there are a whole bunch of recordings sitting in the archive where there are artists which probably should be getting this sort of secondary featured artist status rather than being grouped in with the other session musicians. So maybe they have opened a bit of a floodgate.
Yes,
there.
I mean, and as well as, yeah, not wanting to diss Bowie, they were also not wanting to diss session musicians. It was like, session musicians do great stuff, but I'm not a session musician.
On these tracks,
yes.
Anyway, specifically on these tracks. So we will see whether or not there is any progress in public on that debate in the future.
Mm. Still to come, Tegan and Sarah think up a way to fill empty seats left by unsold touted tickets. But now, the US government is once again getting ready to publish its annual Notorious Markets Report.
Which I always think sounds more exciting than it really is. It's exciting to me, but I think that sounds like something really groundbreakingly... There are going to be big revelations in this, and it's basically the US government's annual here's some websites that do piracy stuff document.
Yes, it names and shames websites, apps, and companies that the American copyright industries reckon are responsible for particularly high levels of piracy.
And the development in the last week is that the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, has basically put forward its 2019 piracy gripe list. And then the US government will take similar lists from other copyright industries. The movie industry always puts through its complaints, etc. And we have sight of the RIAA's list. So it's an interesting update on which kinds of piracy sites, which kinds of piracy, which companies, which aren't really piracy companies, but might be facilitating piracy. What is it that is bothering the RIAA in 2019 when it comes to music piracy?
Well, stream ripping is still a big old gripe.
So we've talked about this a lot, that these websites that allow you to take a temporary stream, by which we usually mean a YouTube link, but it could be another streaming service, and you stick it in a website, and then out the other end pops an MP3 that you can download, so that streams that are meant to be temporary become permanent downloads. And stream ripping, has been at the top of the music industry's what we call piracy gripe list. Not just in the US, I mean in the UK as well and elsewhere for quite a few years now. And certainly the RIAA led with stream ripping and then had some stats about certain stream ripping sites and stream ripping in general, saying a lot of Americans are continuing to do this. And I think it's interesting with the stream ripping sites, although you have a generation of music fans coming through who've only ever known music being available on all the streaming platforms all the time for free if you don't want to sign up to a premium account. So old school illegal sources of content like the PPL file sharing networks and BitTorrent through Pirate Bay and stuff like that, they're not interested in that. They may not even really know that exists because they're using Spotify free, they're using YouTube to access their music. But of course, the big difference between free streaming and paid for streaming on a mobile device is generally on the free services, you don't get offline listening.
Yeah.
So if you're not connected to the internet, or if you have limited data in your mobile package, maybe as well as using YouTube and Spotify, you want to have some MP3s on your phone when you don't have internet access, you're not on Wi-Fi. And because you're a Spotify YouTube user, the easiest way to grab those MP3s is to go and use a stream ripping site. So I think that's one of the reasons why stream ripping sites are particularly popular at the moment. I suppose what the RIAA, that stupidly named Terry Body. What they were saying in this report is, we've been shouting about this for a number of years now. There has been some legal action and threats of legal action, which have resulted in some of the really big stream ripping sites. Obviously, YouTube MP3 was the biggest, shutting down, voluntarily shutting down under the threat of legal action, or sometimes once legal papers have actually been filed. But what they were saying was, as is always the problem with piracy sites, you shut one down and then the next day another appears, often borrowing the brand of the one you've just shut down so that people can easily find it on Google. So yes, have had some success getting some stream ripping websites off the internet, but there are still plenty out there to choose from.
Yes, so the RIAA in its submission says, the overall popularity of these sites and the staggering volume of traffic they attract evidence the enormous damage being inflicted on the US record industry. Several countries around the world have found these stream ripping services to be unlawful, including Australia, Denmark, Russia, Spain and Italy. Several stream ripping services have also shut down after a demand or lawsuit from the record companies. Unfortunately, however, new or variant stream ripping services rise up to take their place. It goes on to say that they're routinely monitoring over 200 stream ripping sites, which includes sites in Russia like flvto.biz and tuconv, which have been subject to legal action, although the RIAA tried to sue them in the US courts, and the US courts said, not our jurisdiction, mate, and dismissed it all.
Although the record industry is appealing that judgment, so the case is ongoing. But the fact that quite a lot of those stream ripping sites are based ultimately in places like Russia, or they have their domain names, they all seem to have their domain names registered in Panama these days. Clearly the Panama registry isn't very responsive to copyright owners complaining. The reason why the fact that these sites have bases or the domains registered abroad is important for this particular report is actually the bit of the American government that produces this notorious markets report is called the US Trade Representative. And the reason they create it is for when the American government is having conversations with other governments around the world about trade issues and when intellectual property comes up. In essence, this is a go-to list so that they can say when they're talking to the Russian government or the Panama government or whoever, hey, our copyright industries have problems with these websites that your country is hosting or your country is providing domain names for, etc. So yeah, a lot of focus on websites which are based in other jurisdictions, although mainly those that are being quite prolifically used by American internet users, even though they're based in Russia or wherever.
Another of the big gripes on its big gripe list is the messaging service Telegram, which has links to Russia, although I don't think it's officially based in Russia.
Yeah, I think the company is registered in both the UK and the US, interestingly, but yes, founded by two Russian guys, actually, who previously founded VKontakte, or VK, or Kontakte, depending on how you want to call it, the Russian version of Facebook, the big Russian social networking platform, which used to be on this list.
Yes, and no longer is.
No longer is.
Because they got nostalgic and set up something else.
Yeah, so VK ultimately did licensing deals with the record industry and now runs a licensed streaming service in Russia, a market where Spotify is yet to launch, although I hear on the grapevine, about to. So maybe Spotify is about to arrive in Russia. But VK, now, as far as the record industry is concerned, a legit operation, although the movie industry still had some issues with what was going on VKontakte. But these guys sold VK, and then their next big adventure was the messaging app Telegram, which has become increasingly popular in recent years. It occasionally pops up in the news because it has been portrayed as the messaging app that, say, terrorist groups, particularly ISIS at one point, were making use of, or the alt-right movement sometimes. They say, oh, this is, they use it because this messaging platform has a more slack attitude towards offensive content or content that incites violence or terrorism or whatever. So Telegram is sometimes seen as being a slightly controversial messaging app. But yeah, interesting, given that most of the websites in this document we've seen griped about plenty of times before, but it was interesting that they were raising some copyright issues with the Telegram messaging app.
Yeah, so they have various issues. One of the issues is that it allows users to share files of up to 1.5 gigabytes at a time, which, I mean, that's significantly more than, say, WhatsApp, which will let you share, I think, like a 16 megabyte video or kind of an individual document of up to 100 megs, but it was still considerably smaller than what Telegram's allowing. And Telegram is allowing file sharing of a size where you can share music or even kind of small movie files quite easily.
Yeah, I mean, that would be high-res audio files or some decent video files as well. And yeah, and because it is allowing much higher files to be shared across its platform, the sense is, therefore, people who are wanting to illegally share unlicensed music or movie files are much more prone to make use of Telegram. Also, they talked about how some of the people who have Telegram channels where they're sharing this content have been able to set up little bits of bots, in essence, to do automatic interactivity. So although it's meant to be a messaging app where two people are having a conversation, they've been able to set it up that I can go to a channel and have a conversation with a bit of software that basically asks me, of all the illegal movie and music files we have, which one would you like to download today? And they were basically saying Telegram doesn't seem to be cracking down on any of that. And then they added that they are now issuing takedown requests under American copyright law to Telegram on a regular basis, but Telegram is just passing it on to whoever runs the channel that is sharing this content rather than taking action themselves.
Yeah, and as you might guess, someone who set up a channel on a messaging app to share illegal content is not super concerned when they get a notice telling them that they're sharing illegal content and should stop.
Yeah, so in essence, what the RIAA, I guess, was implying that is under American copyright law with the pesky copyright safe harbor, that really Telegram as the intermediary should be doing something about this content, particularly as some of these files end up being actually stored on Telegram's servers. So they're in essence implying not enough just to pass these takedown notices onto people who we know are going to ignore them.
Yeah.
You should be doing something about the unlicensed content yourself. And, which is a conversation that's come up quite a lot in the last couple of years when it comes to the American safe harbor and takedown requests, is having a policy that if one Telegram channel is just constantly getting takedown requests, so they're clearly a repeat copyright infringer, that you, Telegram, should be doing something about that.
So in this submission, the RIAA says, Telegram makes no apparent attempt to verify that channel operators have complied with our notices and does not seem to have any kind of repeat infringement policy.
So that is what the RIAA are saying in their document for the Notorious Markets report. I mean, as we say, Telegram's corporate listings, I think they are LLPs in both the UK and the US. So you could say, well, actually, the point of this report is for highlighting platforms being used for piracy which don't have a US base and where you should be talking to people elsewhere in the world. But brought it up, I mean, I suppose Cloudflare is another company that quite often gets mentioned in these reports.
And does indeed in this one.
Obviously, it's a totally legitimate internet services company, just listed on the New York Stock Exchange, but lots of piracy websites use it to hide their IP addresses. So I suppose it's not unknown for the RIAA to bring up what are American companies in this report. But I guess what they're saying is, okay, these might be American companies or companies that have some sort of formal presence in America, but they're being used by copyright infringers elsewhere in the world to aid with their piracy.
So that's the RIAA submission to the Notorious Markets report. It's kind of a wish list of things they'd like to see in the final report that all other copyright industries will feed into. So it remains to be seen how much of that list gets into the final thing.
And whether or not the movie industry is also moaning about things like Telegram will be interesting to see the final document.
Which will arrive at some point in the future.
I think in the new year, but I might be wrong. I forgot to check. Hey, we'll probably mention it when it comes out.
Yeah.
So we'll return to this soon.
And finally this week, Tegan and Sarah have been fighting the touts.
Yes.
They've come up with a new way to, well, it's not necessarily fighting against the touts directly, but basically they started a tour in the US. They've got a new album out and an autobiography. They're touring and they realized the first night of the tour, there were around about 200 unsold tickets on secondary ticketing sites. And if those tickets weren't sold, then they would have empty seats in their venue, and they didn't want to have empty seats in their venue because it was a sold-out show. So they came up with a plan to sell off those seats. They basically said, if you turn up a bit before showtime and those seats are still empty, we'll sell all of those seats to whoever comes to the door for whatever you want to pay for them, and all the money we make from that will be donated to our charity.
And I suppose they were targeting the touts in a way, in that what they were saying was, we've seen about 200 tickets, which were presumably bought up weeks previously, still sitting on the second ticketing sites. But hey, fans, don't buy them. Just show up at the venue on the night, because providing nobody else buys them, so I suppose you're not getting a guarantee of entry, but providing nobody else buys those 200 tickets, we'll sneak you in, we'll let you in. I mean, I think it was, you would get in before the headline set, but they were letting a little bit of time after doors opening just to check, because obviously they had no way of knowing if those tickets were sold really last minute. And they were not saying that they were not going to let the people holding those tickets in, which obviously Some artists do. Some artists say, you know, if we know you've bought a touted ticket, we won't let you in. But what they were saying was, we suspect that those tickets won't get sold. That suspicion is even stronger now we've made this announcement, because why would you go and buy those tickets at the price the tout was selling when we are saying you can get in, pay what you want on the door and get those tickets? So that's what they did. They went ahead and did that. And we don't actually know how many empty seats there were in the end, nor how many people got in on the pay what you want basis.
No, they said in a statement before the show that they could be as many as 200 seats, but they didn't know at that stage. So there was someone I saw on Twitter complaining that the show had been delayed because they were selling these tickets on the door and letting people in. So that delayed the start of the show. Whether that's true or not. This person complained about several things. It seemed like they were just a bit of a moany person.
But basically, I suppose, between the support act and the headline act, once they were definitely certain these seats were empty, then they were selling them. And yeah, maybe there was a slight delay getting those people in. But I suppose what was interesting was the response of the fan base to this idea, because some were like, this is a brilliant idea, well done for taking on the touts, really excited that we might now be able to get a ticket for a sold out show without having to pay a tout at potentially a hiked up price. But there were, well, obviously the touts weren't very impressed, but there were also some fans who said, see what you're doing, but we feel like that's disadvantaging us as fans of you.
Well, there are two arguments. I mean, there were fans who said, well, I bought tickets for your show, but now I can't go, and you can't return tickets. So, I mean, I've had to go to the secondary sites, and now, I mean, there's no chance of me selling those tickets now. And others were saying, well, that's a bit annoying that I paid full price for a show, and now you're saying I could get in for like a few dollars. Although, I mean, obviously, if you bought a ticket in advance, you're guaranteed a seat. Whereas if you turn up 45 minutes before showtime and hope that you're going to say, there's no guarantee you're going
to
get in.
No, and you might have to schleck all the way down to the venue and then find, actually, there are no seats.
Yeah.
And you're not getting in. So, yeah, what you're buying with the higher ticket price is the guaranteed entry.
I mean, by making it a charitable donation rather than selling these tickets, they did avoid accusations that they're basically getting paid twice for those seats. Because they have, I mean, whether there's someone in the seat or not, they've made their money already because the ticket has been sold. The thing is that they wanted people to be in the seats. So that's why they're doing this. And they're taking money for charity. I mean, their own charity, but it's still going to a charity. So they're not personally profiting from this.
But there was an interesting parallel, which I know you mentioned in your write-up on this, between something that happened over here with some Ed Sheeran shows recently. Obviously, we know, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, Ed Sheeran and his promoters in the UK, in particular Kilimanjaro, have been very proactive in trying to stop Ed Sheeran tickets from being touted. And they are a promoter who, whenever they find out tickets have been touted, they cancel them, or they had that whole thing where even where they didn't know that ticket had been touted, they directed anybody who bought their ticket on Viagogo into a different line so that when they got to the front of the line, they could then cancel the ticket and sell them another ticket at face value and tell them to go and get back whatever they paid to the tout back off Viagogo. But there was actually a little bit of criticism of one of Ed Sheeran and Kilimanjaro's anti-touting practices about a month ago, I think, in that Ed Sheeran and Kilimanjaro do have an official face value fan-to-fan resale option. So they're saying, okay, we are cracking down on touted tickets. If we see tickets on Viagogo, we'll try and cancel them. But if you have genuinely bought a ticket for a show and you can't come and we don't offer a refund policy, then go to this website here where you can resell your ticket at face value with an admin charge on top. So some fans are now doing that, but crucially, Sheeran had some shows that hadn't sold out.
Yes, so it meant that any tickets that were being resold through these official channels were 10% more expensive than tickets from primary sources. And where the primary sites hadn't sold out, it meant that why would anyone go and buy one of these fan-to-fan resale tickets that were more expensive?
And crucially, whereas if you were reselling them on Viagogo, or indeed quite a lot of the other face value fan-to-fan resale services, you can actually sell them at below face value.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that touts, when they're defending what they do, often point out, which is they often will buy tickets up front for in-demand shows. Initially, they're selling them at hiked up prices. But if it turns out the show doesn't sell out, at the last minute, they heavily discount. And then they'll get some last minute purchases on the day.
And that is indeed what some of the touts were saying about these Tegan and Sarah shows. It's like, you could have bought tickets on a secondary site for like $6, which is, you know, a fraction of what it costs at face value. One of the touts was saying the reason you got empty seats is because no one's interested in you going to your show. But when it's a sold out show and most of the seats are sold.
Yeah, and it's a relatively small number that are still on the Tassie
side. It didn't entirely stand up as an argument.
But crucially, because with the Sheeran face-to-face value resale, they were putting this limitation in place, which was you can resell at face value with admin fee, you can't charge more, but crucially, you can't charge less either.
Yes.
It meant that fans who would have taken a 20 quid hit to get some of their money back couldn't take that hit, which meant they were less likely to sell their tickets because the fans were going to go and buy their tickets on the primary sites. And so some of those fans were saying, I'm now annoyed by your anti-touting practices. And that has been interesting, hasn't it, over the years, that in some ways, artists who try to tackle the touts, in the main, many people congratulate them for that and encourage them and say, that's brilliant, we're glad you're taking on the touts, we don't like the touts. But then there are certain anti-touting tactics that can actually annoy some of your own fans.
Well, I don't think anyone's found a perfect anti-touting tactic, because we're still, unless you're going to let people get refunds on tickets they can't sell,
which no promoter wants to do, because everyone might ask for a refund. If it's raining, people might be at the last minute, oh, I can't bother going out in the rain, I'll just have a refund, please. And then you end up with half an empty venue, plus now you're not making a profit on the show at all.
But as I said, no one's found the perfect system. And the perfect system for the promoters or anti-touting promoters would be to ban ticket touting. But assuming that's not going to happen anytime soon.
As in having a law that bans touting and the touts somehow obeying that law.
Yeah. Then, we're stuck with this imperfect system. I think probably a lot of these things are done to try to just put touts off from buying tickets to certain shows. If you can be like, you're unlikely to sell your ticket because we have these things in place to look after fans, then they go and buy someone else's tickets. And I suppose the Tegan and Sarah thing kind of goes down that route. Because if you haven't sold your tickets, we're just going to sell these tickets. And if fans know that they can turn up at the door and potentially get in for a few dollars, then they're less likely to go over to Viagogo or wherever and buy their tickets there. And so that potentially puts off touts in the future, buying up tickets on spec. But
no one wants to annoy fans in the short term, though.
Yeah, so that's the issue, is that quite often fans get caught in the middle of these battles.
So that is the challenge. They did imply that if it went well, they might repeat this at other shows where similar things have happened, although we don't as yet know whether or not they're going to do that.
No, they haven't really given any indication of how well or badly it went. They said it was an experiment, and whether or not it's an experiment that worked, we'll see. But in terms of, it is, I think we've all been to sold out shows where you're kind of looking down at the audience going, there's a lot of empty seats here and this is a sold out show. And it's like, that must be because the tickets weren't bought by someone who ever intended to sit in the seat.
Or most promoters will tell you, some people just don't show up.
Well, yeah, there's always that, yeah.
Because it's raining or they get a better offer and there are mad people out there who pay 40 quid to go and see a show and then just don't show up. But certainly, at least a portion of those empty seats, and maybe the majority of the empty seats, yeah, they are touted tickets that didn't get sold.
Yes, and so, no artist wants to be going, yeah, we've sold out our show, and then look out and see 200 empty seats. So you can see there are different reasons for this experiment. And if they manage to fill all those seats, then that's nice for them.
And nice for their charity.
Yeah.
Even if they did annoy a number of fans in the process. So I wonder how many fans they annoyed and whether or not that's worth it. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do next. And if they can crack this and get it working, will other artists consider doing something similar?
That's all we've got time for this week. If you've got any questions or comments about what we've discussed on this week's show, email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Christopher Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.